From the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
It imposes all these just terrible, really dangerous rules and mandates on the state that would get rid of every single security or safety protocol that states have in place.
This is your host, Scott Bertram, and that's Hans von Spakovsky, Senior Legal Fellow with the Heritage Foundation. We'll talk with him a little bit later on in today's program as we dive into H.R. 1, the election reform bill, currently being debated in the United States Senate. Up first, Dr. Matthew Meehan, Director of Academic Programs for Hillsdale in D.C. and Assistant Professor of Government. Dr. Meehan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
You know, who says Twitter is worthless? I saw you tweet a few times on a singular topic over the past few months and thought it would make a really good topic for our conversation. And to put it as succinct as possible, we'll call this good poetics and good politics and how they relate. Where do you begin to draw this connection between poetics and politics?
Probably not from Twitter, I suppose would be the short answer. But yeah, so, I mean, in terms of where we draw it from in the sort of Judeo-Christian, Greco-Roman tradition of the West, you know, this is a conversation that you could say started with Socrates in Plato's Republic, the poets and the philosophers, right? And there's this sort of fight between them. Socrates wants to kick the poet out of the beautiful city, but in his arguments, he's constantly quoting Homer, and you can see he's got a big debt to Homer and the Iliad and the Odyssey. And you get to this sort of question of what's the role of poetry in the city. And Socrates says it's so powerful and so profound that, gosh darn it, we probably should just kick the poets out. So that, you know, from the very get-go of the tradition, there's been this question, and from the Judeo-Christian perspective, you can think of, you know, Christianity's relationship to civil society, and you can consider that Genesis offers several accounts of the creation of the world, and uses a lot of sort of beautiful imagery, and is what's, you know, known somewhat impiously as the true myth, right? Not a false myth, but it's the story of our origins, you know, told in multiple ways, you know, to help us understand the nature of God, the nature of creation, the nature of man. So these kinds of poetic instruments, you know, the written word, communication, images, ideas, are fundamental to civil society in a way.
Why does our treatment of words and texts influence how we treat laws and how we treat each other?
Yeah, so you can take this, it's a great question. You can kind of take it in two different ways, I think, that might be useful. One is in that, right, how we treat texts oftentimes is a kind of stalking horse or a practice round for how we wind up treating our fellow man, and how we wind up treating our city, our laws, and various other artifacts, if you want, out there in the real world. So if you read a text and you treat it willfully, and you beat up on it, and you just interpret it like, I'm going to read Alice in Wonderland, and I'm going to look for its various anti-patriarchal transgender, you know, Marxist capital indictments. You're like, okay, you're not paying attention to this text. You're just forcing whatever ideological concerns you have upon this thing. You're not trying to learn from it, listen, engage it, benefit from it, absorb it. You're trying to use it. And so there's a certain kind of habit of tyrannizing over texts, mm-hmm, that can lead to a tyrannizing over other people and the political community. and you can inhabit, like we talk about, a constitution that is something, right, that means something, and you can have a living constitution, which basically means, yeah, I get to sort of inhabit these various laws and constitutional documents and institutions with whatever zeitgeist of the moment I want. It's like force something upon the political community. So those, that sort of being open to reality and open to, frankly, rule of law, open to equality, open to friendship.
So that's one way, Dr. Meehan. What's the other way, in your opinion, that our treatment of texts and words can influence our relationships and the law?
I think it's the actual, not just the process, but the content, right? Good books, wonderful, you know, texts that humanize us, that teach us what it means to be human, that both sort of stimulate the mind to think in a principled way, either tragedy, oops, that's bad, maybe there's better principles than these people operated under, or comedy, like, ah, we're not perfect, but we work our way towards good action and right principle. Those kinds of things wind up both informing the mind and the heart, and teach us, you know, how to be with one another. And all of those could be summed up in a kind of what I'd say is a sort of rhetoric of friendship, where you learn how to move the heart and the mind of other people in a way that is fair and just by being moved yourself in a way that is fair and just, assuming you pick good books and not abusive ideological books to engage. Or if you have to engage those books, you do it with a jaundiced eye and you're careful.
Talking with Dr. Matt Meehan from Hillsdale in D.C., Director of Academic Programs there, on good poetics and good politics. In what ways does our civic life require that we are wise people informed by poetics?
Yeah, right. In many ways. So Thales, one of the ancient Greek sophists, has this line, right? Tell me who a city's poets are, and I care not who make its laws. Hmm. That's overstatement and ridiculous, and you get this sort of politics is downstream from culture. That's only half true, right? Because politics can be upstream of culture, too. You pass a law, and it teaches and informs. Mm-hmm. But either which way, be it culture or politics, the means by which it influences one or the other, right, is through these teaching functions. The way the law and its enforcement, its communications, the way the stories and the images and the narratives, if you want to put it in modern terms, right, these sorts of things wind up informing human action. Either which way, it's informing human action. So civic life is going to require people to have a good civic education and understand how politics works, but also understand how poetics work, how images work, how the cultural side of things is used and sometimes manipulated. That was Socrates' big concern in the Republic. Like, he was very concerned that people were not aware when major changes were being effected through erroneous poetics that were, you know, informing and creating a new way of life. Oftentimes, I think people who care about justice, you know, goodness, truth, beauty in the American way, like, they oftentimes will leave off this this poetic side of things. And you look today at some of the stories being told on Netflix or Amazon Prime series, and you can see a basically acid bath of images that are really eroding a lot of these powerful truths. And so wise civic leaders, citizens, right, will need to be very wary about which stories, what art, which images, what kind of poetry, right, what stories are being told to the next generation in particular, but even to themselves, sort of wearing them down.
We'll pause right there for a moment. Dr. Matt Meehan from Hillsdale in D.C., talking about good poetics and good politics. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. We've been talking with Dr. Matt Meehan from Hillsdale in D.C. He's Director of Academic Programs there and Assistant Professor of Government, about good poetics and good politics. How do good poetics improve the art of friendship?
So, insofar as you learn about the human heart, you learn about tragedy, and you learn about the use of beautiful language to move the human heart, you're basically getting a kind of primer on loving other people in a humane way and communicating with them in a way that doesn't just get the facts out there, but also considers their feelings and how to move their heart in the right direction. That is to say, I have a lot of respect for Ben Shapiro and people at the Daily Signal and other places, but the facts don't care about your feelings is true, but also irrelevant if you're trying to get your friend to embrace certain facts,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, you have to consider their heart. Where are they? How do you move them towards the truth? That's a real art, but it's an art of images and words and persuasion and not just appealing to their intellect, but also appealing to their heart. And that's, the heartstrings, that's the instrument of the poet. And so if you don't have good poetics and you don't think about this, you're going to be a less effective friend in helping your friends towards virtue, right action, happiness, and joy.
And I've seen you speak on this a little bit. Something that stuck with me was your description of also that this helps us remain calm and helps us remain peaceful in our debates and discussions about civics.
Yeah, no, that's right. There's a certain kind of when poetics features as a serious part of your thinking, the heart features in sort of equal parts with the mind. And so there's not just the insistence on being right,
mm-hmm.
but there's the insistence on making sure that the rightness is being couched in the way that's most aimed to help others and affect the goals you have. But there's also this idea of, right, good rhetoric can be fiery and strong in opposition to enemies and evils, but it's also very strong in providing calm, right? That's, people forget, Aristotle in the Rhetoric talks about calm is an emotion, right? To be able to inspire calm is the number one emotion to bring certain amounts of reason
mm-hmm.
into the mind, right? So that's part of it in one sense. But then you need to then cinch it up and help embrace that idea with various other emotions of, righteous anger, properly understood and usually less than people often argue, but also a certain love of the beautiful and the good, joy, even laughter. There's this kind of Republican wit that follows out from, I'm not just communicating truth, I'm communicating truth in a civic way, a civil way. Kiwi citizens, from right, polis, we're friends in politics. That's the basis for civics, is equality of friendship, right, in the civic realm. So I think that's one part of it. And then the other one is kind of what I referenced earlier with regard to you become more attentive to how to manage your own emotions.
And then how can poetics help us discuss and explain these complex truths in our world?
In a certain sense, poetry, a serious study and practice of poetry, will give you the confidence to understand that certain complex truths can actually be communicated successfully in image. Right, for all of Socrates' hemming and hawing about Homer, he ends with the myth of Ur in Book 10 of the Republic.
Mm-hmm.
And Plato decides to create an image of Socrates in argument and write a bunch of imagistic dialogues about Socrates. Right, so you start to realize that simpler images can bring forth very complex truths, but they have to be done just right. and it's about fashioning the right kind of image that faithfully and truly relates real truth and real principle. So the more adept you become at that kind of art, the more likely you are to be able to bring complex civic truths to your fellow citizens, both in debate, but also in education, and just in the general shared joy of being a part of a community. And you'll be able to do that more effectively. And, you know, on a more practical level, I think, frankly, if more people studied this, they'd be more attentive to making sure that the images were there to help people along towards these things. I think there's oftentimes an overemphasis on, I made a really good argument. I was like, yeah, but did you see the stage you were on? It looked really clunky, and your suit was ill-fitting, mm-hmm. and you used the background was this weird laser light and a star as opposed to a beautiful image of the country.
Talking with Dr. Matt Meehan from Hillsdale in D.C. about good poetics and good politics. Final question for you, Dr. Meehan. Having said all this, can good poetics, can this Republican wit that you mentioned previously help make us better citizens?
I think in one sense the answer is no, only if we use it with an intention for good, right? It's a neutral, it's an instrument, right? Can a baseball bat help you in home defense? Well, if you have no upper body strength, right, and are uncoordinated and the bat's in the garage, then no, it can't. But it certainly can help you become a better citizen as an instrument in your hands. And with regard to that question of Republican wit, I mean, a lot of the other, I'd be repeating myself if I kind of went through some of the things that I think are obviously helpful for citizenship that I mentioned. Mm-hmm. But there's another one. This understanding of Republican wit for the American experience is very interesting in that one of the things that poetry teaches you, it's oftentimes called an education in wit, right? How to use images and see things from different perspectives and analogously, right? Not just hear arguments, but sort of pivot and have nimbleness of mind. Part of it is, right, it's the art of laughter and humor. And humor has a couple different advantages in a republic, and a democratic one to boot. One, it inspires equality, right? You can mock people who get too high. Now, you can do that vituperously and meanly, and that's a lesser good, mm-hmm. or a mixed, you know, a lesser of two evils, right? But it does bring people low through vituperative mockery, right? Like, see stand-up comedy, right? That brings, people who have tyrannical ambitions low. But it can also bring someone low by getting them to laugh at themselves, right? And not take themselves too seriously in the wrong way. And that's a huge part of getting justice without falling to riot, mob, war, the breaking of friendships, right, is getting someone to laugh at their position.
Dr. Matthew Meehan, Director of Academic Programs for Hillsdale in D.C., Assistant Professor of Government, talking about good poetics and good politics. Dr. Meehan, thanks so much for joining us on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you, Scott.
Up next, we'll talk with Hans von Spakovsky from the Heritage Foundation about H.R. 1, that election reform bill now being debated in the U.S. Senate. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Compass Sports Cards, locally owned and operated at 1620 East Cypress Avenue across from Hill Collision Center, is your home base for trading cards and signed sports memorabilia with modern and vintage sports cards and collectibles. Compass Sports Cards features baseball, basketball, football cards, and is the largest supplier of non-sports Pokemon cards. Buy, sell, or trade with Compass Sports Cards, open from 11 to 6 Monday through Saturday. Do you have a collection? Have it appraised at Compass Sports Cards before or after hours at 1620 East Cypress Avenue. Call 355-2016 or stop by today and check us out on Facebook. Compass Sports Cards.
A building that's meant to last is not built overnight. And for centuries, the cornerstone has been crucial to guide each brick and wall that comes after. A strong community relies on many cornerstones. So at Cornerstone Community Bank, we've taken our name to heart. Whether it's your business or your family, we'll provide the financial cornerstone that you need to build on. We're local. We're community. We're your cornerstone. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
I'm celebrating local heroes. Tune in the second Thursday each month at 6.05 p.m. right after the news for Heroes of the North State on North State Now. I'm Michelle Slade. During North State Now, we will speak with your neighbors, friends, family, and community members who give back, not to be recognized, but because it's the right thing to do. During these conversations, we will learn what truly makes our community and the people in it. Join me the second Thursday of each month at 6.05 p.m., right after the news, for Heroes of the North State on North State Now.
Where do you go in Shasta County to get advice on the best type of firearm to meet your needs and how to safely carry and use it? The answer is to join the revolution at locally owned Bastiani Arms. Bastiani Arms believes in a better way to serve their customers and providing them with all the information needed to make the right decisions before and after the sale. They have a large selection of guns and ammunition and always special discounts for veterans. Self-protection is your right. Join the revolution at Bastiani Arms, 2539 Larkspur Lane in Reading, 222-8222.
If the American people ever allow private banks to control the issuance of their currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and the corporations that will grow up around them will deprive the people of all their property until their children wake up homeless on the continent their fathers conquered.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Revolution has started.
Sovereign Minds, now on Sundays, 10 to noon.
Hi, this is Matt. I'm your host of Liberty Unabashed. A new show on Sundays, 8 to 9. We're going to have some good music, some deep thought, and I hope you check us out.
This is Ted Lighty with Northern Firearms Instruction. In response to COVID-19, NFI has scheduled online Zoom classroom sessions for CCW and CCW Renewal. These online courses will be followed up with live fire range training, which will complete your certification. Follow-on range training is done with the same great instructors you've come to know and love. Give us a call today at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Light, and remember, it's our right and our responsibility.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. You can get an email every time there's a new episode of this program. Head to radiohour.hillsdale.edu and enter your email address, radiohour.hillsdale.edu. We're joined now by Hans von Spakovsky. He's manager of Election Law Reform Initiative and senior legal fellow, the Mies Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation, heritage.org. Hans, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure, thanks for having me.
We talked today about H.R. 1, the election bill that is currently making its way through the Senate after having passed the House. Democrats call it For the People Act. Before we get into the details, Hans, you have to tell us, how can you be opposed and what's so dangerous about this voting rights bill? He asked, tongue planted firmly in cheek.
Well, actually, they ought to rename it For the Fraudsters Act, because that's what this does. It's in essence a federal takeover of the administration of elections, taking it away from states. And it imposes all these just terrible, really dangerous rules and mandates on the states that would get rid of every single security or safety protocol that states have in place. I mean, just a quick example of it is, if you're a state that's been smart enough to put in a voter ID requirement, that would no longer be enforceable. No state could enforce a voter ID law, and that's just one of many bad provisions in H.R. 1.
And that voter ID provision specifically, Hans, this is an issue that you go back years, heck, even more than a decade, I know I've been talking with you. Voter ID is an extremely popular measure. In many polls, 65%, 75%, in some polls, even a majority of Democrats support voter ID laws. This bill would eliminate them across the country.
This is one of those areas where the constituents of the Democratic Party do not agree with their leadership, because this is a party line issue. H.R. 1 was passed in the U.S. House on a party line vote. It's now in the Senate, and it has so many provisions in it that just defy common sense. And the polling shows the American people do not like its provisions, like banning voter ID laws.
Another provision in H.R. 1, Hans, is universal automatic voter registration. Why is that not the best idea?
Well, because what it would require states to do is to register to vote without asking them first. Individuals in their state who have dealings with state agencies. So if you have multiple dealings with multiple state agencies like the DMV to get a driver's license, perhaps a state unemployment office to get unemployment benefits, all of those offices are going to be sending your information to get registered, and it's no doubt going to lead to multiple registrations of the same person. Also, many individuals dealing with state agencies like that are not U.S. citizens, and it's highly likely that they are also going to get registered. And add on top of that, it doesn't just apply to state agencies having to automatically register people. It also applies to federal agencies. So federal agencies are going to have to figure out, well, who in their records is a resident of which state, and then they have to send that information. So that's going to lead to people being registered in multiple states. So mm-hmm. It's just going to make our voter registration rolls even worse than they already are.
And Hans, talking H.R. 1 with Hans von Spakovsky here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. The concept of ballot harvesting, people might have heard the phrase when it came to this past presidential election. It's legal in some places, not allowed in other places. Give us a little definition about ballot harvesting and what would H.R. 1 do about it?
In every state, you can mail back your absentee ballot if you're going to vote that way. You can hand deliver it. A member of your family can hand deliver it. Most states, a designated caregiver can hand deliver it. But in most states, they have banned third-party strangers from delivering your absentee ballot. That's again, common-sense requirement, because you don't want candidates and campaign staffers, party activists, and political consultants to be able to get their hands on your absentee ballot, because they could potentially alter it, change it. They might not deliver it if they know you vote for candidates of the other party. Plus, it puts them in the position of showing up at the front doors of people in their homes, voters, where they could coerce and pressure voters. So many states, like North Carolina, for example, ban it. This provision would override all of those state laws and require states to allow vote harvesting by third-party strangers. Again, this is just a reckless change in the law if this bill passed the Senate and was signed by President Biden.
What does H.R. 1 say, Hans, about disclosure provisions? We have seen supporters being targeted when some of their donations have been made public, even recently some donations that have been leaked. People have been targeted for making various donations to political entities. What does H.R. 1 say about the ability to do that with some level of privacy?
Yeah, you know, we've been concentrating on the administration provisions, but this is a 900-page bill. It has a whole section changing federal campaign finance laws. And look, nobody disputes the fact that we should have disclosure of donations to political candidates and to political action committees, but this bill would extend the disclosure requirements to all kinds of nonprofit associations that don't spend 100% of their time on politics at all. And of course, the problem with that is that this is intended, it's very clear, this is intended to force those organizations to disclose their donors and their members so that they will be subject to harassment and intimidation, and to dry up resources for organizations that the left does not like because of its stance on issues, not because they participate in political campaigns, but because they may be, for example, pro-Second Amendment and anti-abortion.
Hans von Spakovsky with us, Heritage Foundation, heritage.org, as we talk the provisions inside H.R. 1. H.R. 1 also would set up a public funding program for candidates running for Congress, so you would, in effect, have congressional members in the House and in the Senate voting to force the public to fund their own campaigns through H.R. 1.
Yeah, that's really one of the most outrageous parts of the bill is this public funding program. And by the way, there was a single Democrat who actually crossed party lines to vote against H.R. 1 when it was being considered in the House. And he, in fact, cited that very provision for the reason that he voted against it, because he said his constituents did not want to be put in the position of having their taxpayer funds subsidizing the campaigns of candidates who they didn't like, didn't agree with, and would never vote for in a million years.
Hans, you can read more about this bill from Hans over at heritage.org and over at dailysignal.com. And Hans, we see some states acting, right? Georgia, of course, Arizona, Florida,
right,
to pass some election reform bills into law. What can, what should individual states be doing on this matter that might be a whole heck of a lot better than H.R. 1?
Florida and Georgia have, for example, passed very comprehensive election reform bills. And those bills, despite all the unfair criticisms of them, are actually good bills. You know, they do things like, in Georgia, extending Georgia's voter ID requirement to absentee ballots, which is something they ought to do. They have banned private funding of election officials, something that happened in the last election and frankly, may have potentially changed the outcome by providing unequal opportunities to vote in urban areas versus more rural areas. And they've done a whole series of steps like that to just fix basic vulnerabilities in the system. But both the Florida law and the Georgia law are good examples for other states of what they ought to be doing to ensure the fairness and security of their elections.
Hans von Spakovsky, manager of the Election Law Reform Initiative and senior legal fellow at the Mies Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation, heritage.org. To read more, Hans, thanks for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Sure, thanks for having me.
Up next, Dwight Lindley from Hillsdale's English Department returns for his occasional series on Victorian poetry. Today we talk Robert Browning. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Every Monday from 6 to 8 p.m., join us at Radio Wasteland, your local guide to the unexplained and the unknown. Each week, we cover all things unexplained, from the moving stars in the sky to the things that go bump in the night. Visit us as we explore these topics and more as our in-studio team digs deeper with featured guests and listener call-ins. Mondays are rough, but now your overworked brain has a chance for some sweet relief with Radio Wasteland.
Radio Wasteland, Mondays at 6 on KCNR.
Remodeled kitchen, bathroom, or backyard patio? There's a lot of choices, but only one leader, Estate Granite.
Mike Huber has such a professional attitude and a can-do work ethic that makes him a joy to work with. Mike and his crew worked to have our new kitchen finished in 5 days. We came back to a true work of art.
Hi, this is Brian Salato, broker and co-owner of the Real Estate Group. In today's competitive market, I think what's important is that the house is dialed in and turnkey. And what's important is that the kitchen has been renovated, the bathrooms have been renovated, granite, beautiful cabinetry. Those things make a significant difference.
Mike at Estate Granite has an eye for detail, an attention to perfection, and a quality build crew that are masters of their craft. Mike was there from start to finish.
Hi, this is Mike from Estate Granite. I know how important quality to a homeowner is, so give me a call at 241-STONE or come by our showroom at 4900 Mountain Lakes Boulevard or visit us at estategranite.com.
At Shasta Regional Medical Group, we're focused on the health matters that matter to you, like having a primary care doctor you trust. Our physicians put patients first. They take the time to listen to your needs and concerns, and they provide the information you need to make good decisions about your own health. At Shasta Regional Medical Group, you have an integrated network of caregivers and specialists working to serve you in a compassionate, patient-centered environment. We're conveniently located right across the street from Shasta Regional Medical Center. To make an appointment, call Shasta Regional Medical Group today at 605-4260 or visit us online at ShastaRegionalMedicalGroup.com. Shasta Regional Medical Group. Your primary care is our primary concern.
Dale Winter. If you're anything like me, your pets are not only your best friends, they're part of your family. American Humane, which has been rescuing animals like Cleo here for more than 100 years, has life-saving tips that can make a big difference in a disaster. When disaster strikes, you want to protect your whole family, including your pets. To help keep your family safe and help our best friends in their worst times, find tips at AmericanHumane.org.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. For more information about Hillsdale College for prospective students, for friends of Hillsdale, or for alumni, head to hillsdale.edu. We're joined by Dr. Dwight Lindley, Associate Professor of English here at Hillsdale College. Dr. Lindley, thanks for joining us.
Thanks again, Scott.
We return with our occasional series on Victorian poetry here on the program, and today we talk about Robert Browning. What should we know about Robert Browning as we begin to discuss him?
So Robert Browning, unlike Alfred Lord Tennyson, whom we mentioned in an earlier series, in an earlier program, was a little bit more of a fringe character in his time. He wasn't from the Anglican establishment religiously, as Tennyson was. He didn't go to the university, partially for that reason. You know, in the religious culture of that day, you had the establishment, which were the Anglicans, and then you had the dissenters, who were Protestants who didn't want to be Anglican. You Methodists, Baptists, and other kinds of evangelicals, we could group amongst them. And he grew up in that set. And so his parents were well-to-do. He was well-educated, but all at home and by tutors, private tutors, didn't go to university. And so he was a little bit of an outsider culturally in a way that Alfred Lord Tennyson, say, wasn't. That's one bit of background. Another bit of background I think is important is he lived a lot overseas.
Mm-hmm.
Spent a lot of time, a lot of his life in Italy, actually. A lot of his poems are set there. And he famously married the poetess, the female poet Elizabeth Barrett Browning, who at the time was more famous than he was.
Mm.
He was really marrying up in terms of literary reputation. I would say since then, since the end of their lives, his poetry has actually been more prominent than hers.
So as we look at some of the works of Robert Browning, what are some of the themes that we discover in his work?
Well, so I think the funny thing about his themes, they all center around the peculiarity and mystery of life. And let me explain what I mean. He had a view of life that it's in the smallest elements of our lives, the smallest details of our lives that we are really revealed. In these littlest things that only the people who know you best may catch about you. And these are the things that we commonly miss about one another.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we pass each other like ships, you know, ships in the night. And as in our own world today, 21st century, so in the Victorian period, you had massive metropolises like London, where Browning lived much of his life, where a lot of people were Johnny-come-lately. They hadn't grown up there. They had moved in from here and there, hither and yon. And so you had a lot of anonymity,
mm-hmm.
like you do in the contemporary city. And he thought with his poetry, he wanted to try to notice little things about others and about lives that could mysteriously open up the depth dimension of people. And I just wanted to read a bit of... There's a famous poem of his called Fra Lippo Lippi. That means Brother Lippo Lippi, who is a famous Renaissance Italian poet. Excuse me, painter. Filippo Lippi, if you go to Florence today, you can see his paintings there. Well, Browning imagines himself within this guy's life from 500 years ago and thinks about his own poetic art by analogy with this guy's paintings. So he has this fellow say, and this really speaks for Browning and his own art. He says, in your art, in your poetry, count it a crime to let a truth slip. And so he's trying to notice everything and not to let anything slip by. And then he says, for don't you mark, we're made so that we love first when we see them painted, when we see other people painted or caught in art. things we have passed perhaps 100 times nor cared to see, and so they are better painted, better to us, which is the same thing. Art was given for that. God uses us to help each other, so lending our minds out. And that's the end of the quote. So what he's saying there is, when a Renaissance painter, or when he, a poet, when an artist tries to capture somebody else in the details and the concreteness of their life, the gift there, if it's good art, it's going to open that person up in a way that you might, in a way that you wouldn't get normally, mm-hmm. right? To show you things that you would pass by without seeing. And he even goes beyond that and says, God lends our minds out to each other to do that. So it's interesting. He doesn't just think this happens in art. He thinks this happens in communication, too. When you tell a story about someone, I may see something about that person that I've never seen before because of your angle and mm-hmm. the thing that you noticed. Anyway, but that art is especially good at doing this, and poetry, as he's saying. So one of his themes that he's interested in is this human work of capturing the meaning and charge of a life in the little things that define that life. So that's one big thing, the kind of magic of the particular. Another thing we could point to that really defines his work is what I would call the ephemerality of society in contrast to romantic love. So on the first day when we talked about Victorian society mm-hmm. as a background for poetry, notice we talked about how everybody's moving to the city, it's urbanization, big cities, and movement and excitement, and there's a lot happening. Well, this left a lot of people feeling alienated, as we still do, you know, in modern urban culture, mass culture. Well, for Browning, one solution to that, or one response you can make to that is, well, you got to remember, society and politics, as important as they are, that's all kind of ephemeral and passing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really not as important to us as these one-on-one relationships, especially romantic relationships we have with others. And there's a poem I just wanted to read a couple of lines from, which he called Love Among the Ruins. This was written in 1852, right in the middle of the century. And the striking thing about this poem is you've got a shepherd and a shepherdess, or a man and a woman, in the middle of fields that used to be the site of an ancient city that was glorious. And that city is now in ruins, and they are grazing their flocks there, and they're in love with one another. And it's clear the speaker in this poem is remembering the glories of that ancient city in all of its pomp and grandeur, and contrasting it over and over again with the very simple just togetherness that he has with this woman. And he says that compared to all of those centuries of folly, noise, and sin, he says finally, what I have here is better. Love is best, is the way that he ends the poem. And this is a theme for him over and over again, is you're never going to find what you want in mass culture, which is very much what they had, just like we do.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to find it in smaller scale, one-on-one relationships, friendships of all kinds, but especially romantic. And this is one of his kind of responses to the day.
That's a fascinating theme to me. When he's writing, does he consider what he's doing something that might be talked about 170 years later, something that would be reevaluated and perhaps, again, as you mentioned earlier, maybe vaulted above the work of his wife in the future as well? Is he thinking he's creating these things that will last?
He's certainly trying to. I don't think that he was the kind of person who would aspired to be known better than his wife, which is not what you were saying, but I mean, he was humbler than that, but certainly he was trying to write timeless poetry, and poetry that would last. He loved the work of the poet Shelley, and there's a famous poem by Shelley called Ozymandias about how the work of the artist outlasts the work of the politician. and that's very much what Browning was going for. He was going for something that would outlast the particularities of his day and give people something to think about, something to work through and see the world through for centuries. Yeah.
Dr. Dwight Lindley, Associate Professor of English at Hillsdale College, on our Victorian Poetry Series and talking Robert Browning. Dr. Lindley, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Scott.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Matt Meehan from Hillsdale, N.D.C., talking good poetics and good politics. Hans von Spakovsky from the Heritage Foundation told us all about H.R. 1. And Dwight Lindley on Robert Browning. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spotify, or Amazon Podcasts. Search for the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Follow the show on Twitter at Hillsdale Radio or over on Facebook. Email us at radiohour@hillsdale.edu. Until next week. I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
North State Now is a magazine formatted show at 6 p.m. every Thursday night. The first Thursday is yours truly, Linda Bott, featuring what's going on in our town. The second Thursday is hosted by Michelle Slade, featuring heroes of the North State. The third Thursday is hosted by none other than James Masada and Rhonda Alvey from Enjoy the Magazine and Enjoy the Store. Our newest edition is the fourth Thursday of the month, Women of Vision. That's North State Now, Thursday at 6 p.m., also streaming on KCNR 14.
This is RC from Tobacco and Brew, bringing you this month's Cigar of the Humidor. For this month, we're reviewing Arturo Fuente's Hemingway Classic. With curves of a supermodel, this Perfecto has a superbly balanced, toothy, and attenuated Cameroon wrapper and pairs exquisitely with a complex filler and binder that indulges the palate with citrus, coffee, cocoa, and cedar. Come down to the shop for your Arturo Fuente Hemingway Classic today. 2143 Hilltop Drive, Reading.
Premier, your friendly oil change. Premier in all we do.
Premier Oil Change has been locally owned and operated since we opened in 2006, enjoying long-term relationships with our team members and loyal guests. Many of our team members have worked with us for over 10 years. Many of our certified technicians have logged over 30,000 oil changes, working on hundreds of different vehicle makes and models. In an ever-changing world, we strive to keep up with change. With our extensive training program, it's important to the staff at Premier Oil Change that our customers' cars are well taken care of by experienced, well-trained technicians. So you can depend on your vehicle to get you and your family to your destination. Don't forget that you can earn free oil changes with Premier Rewards. Learn more at PremierOilChange.com or visit us in Palo Cedro. Premier is in the Holiday Market Shopping Center or in Reading on Lake Boulevard next to Waterworks Park or our newest location in Anderson across from Roundtable. Remember, you get a free car wash with every oil change. Premier Oil Change, home of the friendly oil change.
Hi, this is Brian Martin, General Manager of River Common Senior Living. One of the most rewarding things about what I do is watching the positive transformation that often occurs when a senior moves here to our beautiful, independent retirement community. Seniors can become isolated, find it hard to eat good, healthy meals, and even just get around. I call this a failure to thrive. At River Commons, we solve those challenges. You are surrounded by friendly people with similar life experiences. Chef Shalisa and her crew provide three delicious and healthy meals daily. Activities Director Ernie always has a wide variety of things to do, from arts and crafts to outings on our 25-passenger bus. Plus, we provide utilities, cable TV, scheduled transportation, weekly housekeeping, and more. We see seniors go from survive to thrive, and that is just a wonderful thing. Call today for a tour or luncheon a tour and experience River Commons for yourself. 221-2121 or on the web river-commons.com.
Colonoscopy is the most effective method of screening for colon cancer and is the only procedure that can both detect and prevent cancer in one procedure. Take-home tests can miss up to 1 in 12 of colon cancers and most precancerous polyps. If you're 50 or older, now is the time to schedule this life-saving test. When caught early, the survival rate of colon cancer is 90%, so stop making excuses and get screened. This public service message is brought to you by Reading Endoscopy Center. Call them at 530-246-7000 or visit readingendoscopy.com.
People constantly make pop culture references. That's why it's called popular culture, because people are aware of it and reference it constantly. Seth Rogen.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Hole.
And I'm Lee Esses.
Our question of the day is,
can I use names of copywritten material in my book? Quotes and songs, that kind of thing.
Yes and no.
Do not let your entire book be citing word-for-word Twilight. That's not going to fly.
That is copyright infringement. There are some things that you can do. We're going to talk today about the specifics. Break down what you can and can't do according to the law. Now, we are not lawyers. We are not copyright experts. If you have a question, if you're concerned about it, your best bet is to go to legal sources, not some random person on the internet who says that they know a lot about it.
So one of the questions you have to ask yourself is, do you plan on making any money with the writing? If it's fan fiction or something like that, you are not going to be allowed to make money with the writing. You can write all you want, but it's when money gets entered into the equation that these questions even come up. If you don't plan on selling your book ever, then just, you know, have fun.
Skip this episode and move on. It doesn't apply to you.
Right, selfishly.
First off, if it was written 95 years ago, so as of recording right now, if it was published before 1925, you're good to go. It's in the public domain.
What is public domain?
Public domain means that it was created so long ago that it now belongs to the public in general.
This is not to say that it's uncopywritten, because in a way it is, because you cannot take the Bible word for word and publish it and copyright it and then say no one else can write it. It is in public domain, meaning it's more or less the copyright is held by everybody. So if you're writing a fan fiction of the Canterbury Tales, where they finish the travels, go for it, have fun. But you aren't allowed to make money off of Harry Potter and J.K. Rowling's world that she's built, because that's hers. She owns the copyright. She's the one you need permission from and probably need to pay a lot of money to in order to create new content in that world.
Now, there is something to help you in this, and it's called fair use. Fair use allows the use of trademarks and certain copyrighted material under very specific circumstances. There's a couple of things that you need to consider before you can classify what you're using as fair use. I got this list from Standout Books. They're a publishing services company. And they list four things that you need to consider before you can consider your use of that copyright or trademark material under fair use. The very first is if you are using it in a commercial for-profit situation, or if it is educational and or valuable in some way to humankind as a whole. Valuable to you is not valuable as a whole.
That goes back to what we started the episode with. Are you making money on it? Because that needs to come into consideration.
You also need to consider the nature of the copyrighted work and what it is that you're referencing. You cannot take, like we said, the entire script of Twilight and publish it yourself. Because that goes into the next part, is the amount of text that you are referencing. A little bit here and a little bit there is fine. Entire chunks, not so much.
Yeah, I can't copyright the word the. That's too small of an amount to limit the rest of the world from using that particular tool in their storytelling.
And the final thing is you have to consider what the effect will be on the original copyrighted work in its potential market value, which is why you can't just republish something that somebody's already written, because that directly affects their potential in the market.
So if I have a character who's 11 years old and he has a lightning scar and he discovers he's a wizard, there's going to be some issues there. If I have a character who's 11 years old and he's...
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.